Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. In the New in Chess podcast, we talk to leading grandmasters, authors, trainers, and other personalities from the fascinating world of chess. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT is the only brand that provides everything you need to broadcast the games of a chess event, from the chess clocks to sensory chess boards. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geuzendam. My guest in this week's episode is a very special one. It's none other than five-time world champion Viswanathan Anand. Commonly known as Vishy Anand, he is one of the greatest and most popular champions in the history of our game and one of its most admired and respected ambassadors. Anand was the first ever Indian grandmaster, and look what happened in his wake. Today, there are more than 80 grandmasters in India. It's truly unbelievable. Although no one could blame him if he decided to rest on his laurels, Vishy Anand remains active as a player, and he is still ranked number 13 in the world, which is frankly incredible. But in the past years, he has also taken on new roles. He is Deputy Vice President of FIDE, and he is a partner in the Westbridge Anand Chess Academy in Chennai, where the cream of the highly successful young Indian generation is training, and no doubt many youngsters whose names we do not know yet. Vishy Anand joins us from León in Spain, where he's playing in the invitational group of the annual Magistral, an international rapid and blitz tournament. Vishy, good afternoon. Thanks a lot for accepting the invitation to the New in podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be on, Dirk-Jan.
With a unique career like yours, it's really impossible to do a career-spanning interview. That's simply too much. I mean, with all due respect, you've won so much, it's frankly ridiculous. You've been world champion in all the formats that we've seen. You've won all the great traditional tournaments, and many of them on multiple occasions. It's an endless list, starting from when you became junior world champion and even earlier, and continuing to this day. So, in fact, when I was thinking about your career, I was wondering where all your trophies have gone. I mean, we've seen videos of your home where you show people around, and there's some of them on display there, but it's only a small selection. I mean, where do you keep them, and how big is that collection?
So this actually was a sort of problem. My parents were collecting a lot of trophies. Also, they would collect all my newspaper cuttings and so on. From back in the day. So there's a lot of material I got from them. And I'm someone who probably didn't pay much attention to this area when I was young. Now I wish, you know, I'd kept not all of it, but there are things you suddenly think, well, it would be nice to look that up. But I think my parents, obviously being more experienced, they understood that this thing would be nice. So they collected a lot of stuff. Then for a while, I was haphazard. Whenever I would bring something home, I'd give it to my parents. They'd find some spot for it. And after my marriage, my wife started helping me a lot. This thing started to accumulate. So we had a little bit in my parents' place. We had things in our house in Spain, things in our house in India, and scattershot. And 7 years ago, we moved to our current residence, and we finally, Aruna managed to design the house, and she had this idea that we need to dedicate quite a bit of space to trophies, also a lot of souvenirs, memories, and so on. And I think this is probably, must be 75-80% of it, but there's stuff here and there as well. Some of my Spanish stuff remains with Morris and Nieves. I think their son Manolo got it. I suspect he doesn't have it anymore because he also moved and so on. Things like that. But yeah, the rough story is that's where it is now.
Yeah. Because it simply takes an awful lot of space. I mean, especially if you win that much.
Yes, and
it's a lot.
Also, you do have to prioritize. I mean, some things are really very nice. you cannot really hold on to every junior open trophy. At some point, you have to let a few ones of those go, or you take a photo and you leave it at that. So you do have to, at some point, it becomes important to say, well, what do you want to actually share with people? So,
yeah. Well, and then when we briefly talked about you appearing on the podcast, it was clear that there's so much that we could talk about. But I suggested that we speak about two early memories. One actually lasted 20 years. One of your first huge victories was in 1992 in Reggio Emilia in Italy, where you won a tournament ahead of the entire world top. And in that same year, the Amba tournament was born, a very, very special tradition, rapid tournament, rapid and blindfold. I think it was an important moment. Well, it was actually, you could say, it was the beginning of your career as a world-class player and one who's playing a dominant role in all the major competitions. So it was at the end of 91, and in December you had just turned 22, and you traveled to Italy, where there was a tournament which was composed of 10 players. There were 9 players from the former Soviet Union, which had just fallen apart and was now, I think, officially called the Commonwealth of Independent something. I forget what it was. And then there was you. So all the Russian and Soviet stars were there, like Kasparov, Karpov, Pologuyevsky, Salov, Khalifman, and you won. Do you remember with what kind of feeling you traveled there? Because in the previous year, in 91, you had had your first successes. You won a candidates match against Rayev. Then you came very close to defeating Karpov in the candidates match. So it wasn't that you were, appearing out of the blue. But what were your own feelings? Do you remember, were you seeing it as a big challenge, or was it even something frightening too?
I think I went to it as simply another great tournament. Maybe I had some feeling that at some point I would win one of these things. In fact, but it's not like I suspected or felt that things were around the horizon. In fact, it's probably like this for many people. Nobody really senses their breakthrough coming, but it happens, and then they realize, oh, I'm even stronger than I am, than I thought. But it's true, 91 was an eventful year, 90 especially, because I qualified for the candidates. Back in the day, that opened doors like nothing else in chess. And then I got this famous fax from Linares at some point in late 1990. And so I knew I had that tournament after my match with Drev. So I finished Drev, then I went and played in Linares. Where I played Karpov in the second round, Kamsky in the first. I won, I beat Kamsky, beat Karpov, and then, went all over the tournament. But 91 was eventful, you're right. Brussels, I came very close to beating Karpov. First time in the big time kind of thing, big league. And even more so, I came close to winning Tilburg. And 91 was also a year where I was genuinely getting used to the top of world chess. I mean, these are the nicest events, Linares, with its quirks, but it's got something to it. Tilburg as well. I mean, Interpolis was sort of legendary for having very, very high class events. And everybody praised the organization there. I mean, famously, you could call any cab, or you just call a taxi, and then you sign to Interpol. It's that kind of thing. So very nice event. And I had trained in Osterweg the previous year, because I asked Van der Wiel if I was going to train with Hellers and Van der Wiel, and I asked Van der Wiel if he knew some nice place to train. He says, well, actually, we can go to this place where the participants of Tilburg stay. It's a nice, these rental cottages. And so anyway, so in Tilburg, I beat Karpov, Kasparov, Korchnoi, Kamsky, Nigel, all in the same tournament, Barev. But I managed to lose five games as well. And some dramatic stuff. I lost better position against Karpov. Then I lost close to a winning position against Kamsky. But I beat Gary in the second half. And I finally ended up in third place. But so anyway, I went to Tilburg. I mean, I went to Reggio Emilia, which I played before in 89, but not nothing spectacular. And it was the most unglamorous entry. I remember there was an announcement of an airline strike in India. So I decided that I should fly a day or two early just to avoid any travel issues. So I got there on the 24th of December. And I messaged the organizer, which means I sent him a fax. The organizer was nice enough to come to the hotel, and he had lunch with me or something like that.
Was that the banker or was it Enrico Paoli?
No, it was the banker.
Yeah.
And then he said, I will see you day after tomorrow. And I was a bit surprised. The time when I realized that everything is going to shut down on the 25th. I mean, this is not a problem in India. Yeah. And I did not appreciate that just everything shuts down on the 25th. So the 25th morning, I come down for breakfast and there's no one at breakfast. They've just left some stuff, plastic stuff. You have to open the biscuits, pull them out, eat them yourself. there was no warm breakfast, let's put it that way. They just had a... so I had to eat some stuff. And then I realized there was nothing to do the whole day. And it was cold. And how long can you sit in your room? And there was of course, we were talking pre-internet. So I remember going for a long walk, looking for some place that was open. I found that there was one Chinese restaurant somewhere which was open, of course. I had something. I got lost along the way. It took me an hour and a half to get back. I got back to the hotel and then just somehow. Then anyway, 26th, life came back to normal. So, also, I had no sense of history in the making. Technically, Reggio Emilia started in 91 and finished in 92. So I had no sense of any history or anything happening. Because also news wasn't all over the place then. I mean, at most you had some TV channel and nothing more. So even if there was drama somewhere else, there was no, you didn't have the feeling something was happening. Anyway, I did my typical thing in those days, which was to win the first two games and then lose the, this time I lost the fourth, not the third. I didn't lose the third. I drew with Halifman and then I lost the fourth, whereas all in Linares, the previous Reggio, I can say 1 year I would win the first two and then lose the third, and I hated that.
But of course, the big thing was that the second win was against Kasparov. I mean,
yes,
that was.
I beat Valery Salov in the first game Berlin, which had. In those days, you didn't think that beating the Berlin was something special, so you just beat it. And now you think, my God, I'm a hero. I'm an artist. Yeah. So. Those days, it hadn't quite gotten its fearsome reputation. I beat Salov, and then the next day, I beat Gary in a French. This was the second time in like 2 months I beat him. So I'd beaten him in Tilburg, and then again here. And then, of course, when Gurevich beat me in the fourth round, he had been my second, so I think he understood me very well. He just waited for me to get impatient, do something silly, and then I lost. I then had to spend New Year there, and I was sort of tied for first with Gelfand and maybe Gary. And then I got this very, very lucky break in the new year, after the new year, with Pulegavsky. I suddenly, well, with that, I joined the lead again. And, or joined the lead, I forget. And then in the ninth round, I beat Pulegavsky with black. He overreached with white. And unexpectedly, I won with black. So that was great. And next thing I knew, Boris drew against Karpov. Ah, I think that was important. So it was Karpov and Kasparov who were trailing me. I mean, who were with me. So Karpov drew with Boris, which meant that he couldn't join me. And then Gary drew against Halifman. Yeah, suddenly I was first. But of course, the big story was by this time, the Soviet Union had actually collapsed. Famously, Yeltsin, President Yeltsin, had declared Russia its own. So, in fact, Russia left the Soviet Union, and then the others followed. This doesn't seem obvious these days, but that was the order in which it happened, if my memory is, or maybe they were all stampeding out, I don't know. But anyway. And then the first, this name started to appear, Commonwealth of Independent States. And of course, Hans Rey pointed out that, he pointed out that a commonwealth is a collection of independent states. So, Commonwealth of Independent States is a commonwealth of collection of independent states of independent states.
I enjoyed that
very much. And it was a segue into my favorite joke in those days, which is, I'm the last Soviet champion. And there will never be another. So, that's it. So, and that was a nice kind of touch. It was kind of, I mean, I knew I had won the strongest tournament, the highest rated tournament in history.
We shouldn't forget that. I mean, it was announced as the first category 18 tournament in history, the strongest ever. And, well, you had, as you say, also you already had beaten Kasparov on an earlier occasion. But what I find amazing looking backwards is that it was so clear that you were the new kid on the block. And I mean, you were, well, beating them. And still there was this disbelief, maybe partly because you played so quickly or because you were different from them in your attitude. I mean, or the way they thought you looked at the game. How did you experience that? I mean, did you, because it was, you could see that they were still playing the old tricks, that when you won this tournament, then Karpov immediately said, well, you know, this whole thing with categories, I never found that very interesting. Well, which of course he would not have said had he won.
Yes.
So that kind of thing. Were there things that annoyed you there? I mean, they tried to play down your achievements in a way, or maybe because they were afraid, probably because they were afraid.
Yes and no. I think people around me and so on were more annoyed, and definitely there were a couple of journalists in India who picked up this angle and said, well, why are they trash talking him, kind of thing. I probably was surprised at the beginning, and then I realized it's part of the package. But I kind of knew the feeling myself that when someone lost to me after coming close to beating me, then I would always praise their talent. And then if they actually beat me, I would say, but there was nothing special. So it's a feeling I could easily relate to because I had done it myself. I mean, it's just human emotion, right? So, and I had experienced it in Brussels already. In Brussels, Karpov had been this way and that way. He kind of said, yes, he's very good, but of course, you know, Kasparov gave him all his preparation and that was offensive. And then he, of course, made it about himself. And so I had experienced this a little bit before, so it wasn't a surprise. Anyway, what was it? I think it was in 92, so just 4 months later when I played in Dortmund, that I went with our famous Jeroen for dinner somewhere. And he explained to me, I was telling him, you know, Kochnoi says that I basically don't think, I just play some tricks and something like that. And he said, you have no idea. Kochnoi praises me to the skies, and that's because he beats me all the time. So you should enjoy it while it lasts, or something like this. And I think that was a nice way to put things. But this is not something I was totally unaware of. And I kind of had the feeling that I'm coming here. And it was obvious to me that if they praise me a lot when I don't win, and then if the moment I win, I'm not something special, then you pick up on it fast. And like I said, I've done it myself. So it's maybe even a way of coming to terms with it. So.
And I guess the fact that you had Misha Gurevic as your second in Brussels in 91 must have helped, because he knew all that play and he knew how they would react to you. Did that help? That, I mean, he was an insider in that? Or
a little bit. I mean, he would tell me that Kapo would say things as well, and, you know, I can't only expect the game to happen at the chessboard, that sort of thing. But also with Misha, we had time only for a lot of the technical work. So I don't remember all the people who might have mentioned it. But of course, inevitably, you talk with a lot of friends and they... either they tell you it's no big deal, or they laugh and shrug, and then you think, "Oh, that's the way I should take it." So you kind of, I was used to it pretty fast.
Yeah, I think it's so funny that these days people, they still talk about the Soviet school of chess, whether it existed or whether it didn't exist, but of course there was this whole way of how, well, it was some sort of a culture. That, for instance, after you won Reggio, I remember that that there were a couple of old world champions who were there. And Smyslov, he went to Kasparov and he said, why didn't you tell Belyavsky in the last round that he should make a draw against Anand? And then Kasparov said, well, listen, I don't have this power anymore that Karpov had. And which I thought was extremely funny. So, but the entire conversation, I mean, it's hard to imagine that these days.
Yes. Probably Kasparov would find that quite funny as well, because it wasn't, with hindsight, everything looks more obvious. But for me, it wasn't clear that Belyavsky didn't have the right to try and beat me. I mean, in Linares, he had won the most lost position he could have had. So he knew that my fluctuations were quite big. So that he should try to beat me was quite, I thought, a normal reaction on his part. And of course, we know that anyway, Belyavsky doesn't do practical. So, I mean, that's just not Belyavsky. So, but yes, later on, there were many stories about Karpov and I think even one involving Smyslov in Tilburg and so on. So it was a completely different era, of course.
Yeah. But I think one of the things why they find it difficult to get a grip on you was because in these early tournaments you were playing so fast. You mentioned the Linares tournament in 91, and I mean it is a story that I have to repeat because it's so nice that you won against Kamsky in the first round, and you didn't spend too much time, and then you were asked, well, shouldn't you use some more time, and will you use more time tomorrow? And I think it was Mauricio, your good friend, who was asking this. And he says, who am I playing tomorrow? I said, who are you playing tomorrow? Yeah, Karpov. 25 minutes will do. And you just laughed. But I think you came pretty close there. That.
It was after the game with Karpov, actually. It was after the game with Karpov. No, the game was Kamsky, but Maurice, I think, told me after the game with Kapo, because also there was a bounty that Luis Rentero put a bounty on Kapo's head. I don't know if it was, I was the only person who could do this, or it was available to anyone else who had a go. Where he announced a price on Kapo's head if anyone beats him. Another thing they don't put these days. But so Maurice mentioned this to me, and I told him, well, if I beat Kapo, I'll pay him the money myself. And we laughed about it and left it at that. And it's the same thing with it was the same thing with this. Why don't you slow down a bit? So I think he told me, you took only 14 minutes yesterday. You need to spend a little bit longer. I said, well, would 15 help? And we laughed about it. I don't remember exactly when thing, but I actually did it against Jan Elvest in round 4, where I finished the whole game in 14 minutes. So it could also happen there. But it's a fantastic story because, I mean, my attitude is someone who's been told all his life to slow down. And I think Boris was more sincere with his advice.
Whereas my own
feeling was, that old chestnut again. Here we go.
This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT is the only brand that provides everything a chess event needs to broadcast its games. With DGT, you elevate the tournament experience for both players and spectators. For all your chess competition needs, visit dgt.nl.
Well, if you go back to Red Show, it was a very special tournament. I mean, it was Category 18. But as you said, there were tournaments like Tilburg and Linares, which were slightly more glamorous than Red Show. Because it was stunning that for such an important event, you were playing with plastic pieces. The players had to use the same toilets as the spectators, which especially for Kasparov, I remember this look on his face when he had to fight his way through the crowd to go to the toilet, and even sometimes had to stand there waiting. So it was a very peculiar mix. They wanted to have the biggest chess tournament in the world, and at the same time, it was so amateurish. Did that bother you? Or?
No, the first time I even heard about it was when you told me this afterwards. You asked me, you wanted to interview me after the thing, and you mentioned this thing of Kasparov. You said, doesn't bother you. And I kind of laughed or didn't understand the question.
Okay.
And you, I remember, so it's interesting that it also stayed in your head for a very long time. But you asked me this there, and I said, well, I mean, my attitude was it was the same as, a bit lucky here or something. I just thought, that's a nice try, but it's, I have to admit, this one I really won. And I shrugged it off. I didn't particularly notice that because it was comfortable enough. And maybe I had not gotten so used to luxury that I picked up on details. I mean, of course, many, many years later, Jeroen would do this skit in Amber. Mm. Where he'd pretend to have a cigar and say, you know, this Metropole, it's a nice hotel, but the pillows are not very soft or something like that. And we would both start laughing because we were, of course, in the lap of luxury in Monaco. It kind of maybe felt like that to me at that point. But Reggio Emilia, and then slowly, like I said, my tournament started to get better and better. I started to leave my open tournament days behind me.
Yeah, yeah. And that for the listeners, that Jeroen is Jeroen Piquet, the Dutch
He will come up again in the Amber thing, but anyway.
Yes, yeah. So, in Reggio, I mean, I wasn't the only one who interviewed you because I remember that you were interviewed on the final day by a reporter of the Gazzetto dello Sport. And they were very enthusiastic about them because they saw you as a breath of fresh air in this world. They even praised your leather jacket and your sports shoes, which was a breakaway from the traditional gray suits and black shoes of the Soviets. They really liked you. And what I remember from that occasion is that they he asked you this famous question, Anand, which is your favorite piece? And it was funny that, of course, it's a question that has been asked a million times, but I'd never heard it at that point. And I thought, what is he going to say? Do you remember what you said?
Did I say my night? Or did I say something else?
No.
What did I say?
No, you thought very briefly, and then you said, well, you know, I've lost most of them so often that I've learned not to get too attached to them.
Ah, that was it. Okay,
to any of them. And he was very happy about that. I think it was only a month later that you went to Roggbrunn for the first Amber tournament. Which was a new tournament that nobody knew about, and it was a bit, well, shrouded in mystery. I had heard about it, but I only realized that it was going to take place when it was already over. And some of the details, they were so fascinating that I thought, has somebody been making this up? Because there was this luxurious tournament where a selection of grandmasters were invited to in Roggbrunn, high above Monaco on the Côte d'Azur. And it was organized by a Dutch tech billionaire, Joop van Oostrom. And what did you think when you first went there? I mean, how unusual was it?
Okay, so somewhere in 91, maybe, I reckon it was summer, so it should have been June or July, I gave this blind simultaneous display in the Spoy.
In Amsterdam.
And Hert Hazen came and gave me
the arbiter
came and gave me an envelope and said, there's a new tournament, we want to invite you. I said, okay, I'll take a look, and so on. So I went back to my friend Albert Toby's house, and then we opened the letter and looked at the invitation, and it said, you know, invited to this tournament and thing. I mean, the prize fund was sensational. On top of that, we all got an appearance fee. It said, you know, all your expenses, a phrase which we didn't know quite what to make of it. I mean, we were used to the usual, you go to a place and your room and certain number of meals are taken care of, you're given something. But here, there was pocket money, there was some thing, and on top of that, we could sign for everything, and it seemed a bit, but anyway, the tournament was so good, and something in south of France sounded amazing. And so very quickly I said yes. And later on, Mickey Adams told me the story that he also read the letter and it sounded amazing. And there was the appearance fee. And his father called him. He didn't read it himself. The letter went home. So his father told him this, read out the contents on the phone, and Mickey said, they probably put the wrong currency. It must be French francs. But yeah, it sounds great anyway. And it was sort of my attitude as well. I maybe you will have to mention to your listeners that there used to be a country called France in which there used to be a currency called the French franc, and it was roughly a sixth of the dollar. So you to get your bearings. So it sounded too good to be true. And then when we arrived, I think for all of us who were invited for the first one, for many of us, it spanned, I would say, the best part of our career. It started in 92, it finished in 2011. Ivanchuk played very famously in all of them. I missed two, but essentially it spanned that entire period, and it became the one tournament we look forward to the most. A couple of years down the line, two years later, there would be one more tournament, the Frankfurt Mainz Chess Festival, which also became one of the tournaments I look forward to the whole year. And that also kind of lasted till 2008 for me, so very close. And in 2000, there was this tournament in Corsica, which again, I started visiting. But there it was familiar because it's like, I go to Nice, and instead of going to Monaco, I just pop across to take one more flight to Corsica. And the reason I mentioned this is, of course, I've played all these events more than 10 times. Amber is 18 years.
And they're all rapid events. And they're all rapid events.
So this was my glamour slash vacation circuit, in the sense that we the Frankfurt Mainz thing was always in summer. It was beautiful because, especially in Mainz, it was very nice because we played on the riverbank, so in a hotel right by there. And we, you know, you could go to walks every evening. I mean, again, for me, that was just a tournament that was so pleasant and so much worth looking forward to. Exactly the same with Corsica. Though that happened
October. Well, in Frankfurt, you were the record winner. Yes. I mean, how many times did you win it? 10 times or something?
Yeah, but that included the victories in Mainz. I mean, we're talking, the tournament moved after 5 years to Mainz and then was for the 8 years there. So, but yeah, Frankfurt and Mainz. So that was my friend Hans Walter Schmidt. In Corsica was Leo Battisti. But this one was different from all the others. It was the, so you famously mentioned Joop van Ostrom, who he had made his, I think he played the World Junior along with Spassky, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, in 1955.
Okay.
Spassky won, and he played, I think he finished sixth or something. And Portage also was there. He also played.
It should have been later, no? Because Spassky, is he 20 years older than Karpov? Ah, he is a...
No, this was 55 in Antwerp.
Okay, because Karpov won the World Junior in 69, so I was a bit confused which year it is. Okay, so it was 55 in Antwerp. And then he had gone off into software, this company, Fallmark. Then he had sold it to Capgemini. And, I mean, these are the fragments we got here. But, oh, I remember arriving in the... is it the Vista Palace in Rockbrunn?
Yeah, Vista Palace in Rockbrunn.
I remember arriving in it the first day, you know, just being picked up by some super cab and being driven there, and we got out. We were invited to bring a friend along with the same signing privileges. And so I brought along my Dutch friend, Albert Toby. So we came to this hotel and kind of, I had stayed in good hotels before, you know, I didn't just come out of the forest or something, but still I came to Rockbrunn, I saw the views. So it's perched on top of a rock and you can see all the way down to the sea in, I don't know, a good span of the sky. And so we went there, we sat down, I think Bent Larsen was there already. Corey Fraken was there, Polo Gajewski, I think, was there at that point, and kind of sat there. And then at some point, Joop walked by and said, "You can sign for everything. It's on me."
Yeah.
Again, it seemed funny that this was pointed out, but okay, we thought, well, great. Then we went to our room, which was just fantastic. And again, my room literally overlooked, went all the way down the cliff, and then you could see further out into the sea. And yeah, it was stunning. With time, I mean, you get slightly used to these things. I'm glad I remember the impression it first made on me. Because, of course, second year is, you go back, but you expect it a little bit, and the third year you expect it a little bit. It's harder to surprise you, but that first day we arrived in Vista Palace, I will not forget easily. It was truly spectacular, and of course, just a fantastic event. And on top of that, the opening ceremony had these mermaids on the swimming pool. Each bringing out your number, and that was the drawing of lots. And I think they originally had the idea to do something with the helicopter. Well, you get the picture. It was very, very good fun. And it was a very special tournament. I mean, all the tournaments in those years, I can remember it unusually well for exactly this reason.
Yeah. Well, Jochen Oesterholm, he was very generous, but he was also a very straightforward person. In the Dutch manner. Typical Dutch rudeness or directness. Were you sometimes taken aback by that? I mean, he always spoke his mind.
I had met wealthy people before. Some of them are blunt. And on top of that, I was used to Dutch people by this point. I don't think he was unusually so. He was a wonderful host. Also personally, though, obviously we didn't deal with him. We had quite a lot of staff there just dedicated to us. And we only had to tell them, I'd like to paraglide off the cliff. Yes, sure. At 10 o'clock, I booked this thing for you. Yeah. Sure, and move on, and this sort of thing. We were pampered silly, and of course, 92 was just a fantastic year.
Yeah, because what I remember is that, well, let's say full disclosure, I got involved in the tournament later, first as press chief, and then the last four tournaments I was the tournament director, which was a great privilege. And very often people would ask me, why did Kasparov never play there? And I think there were a couple of reasons, but he was invited for the very first tournament, and they had made a generous offer and everything had been signed, and then suddenly there was a call from Moscow that he also wanted an additional $700 flight ticket. And then Van Oostrom said, okay, just forget about him. We'll take somebody else. And he explained that. He says, I mean, people, they want to negotiate with me. I don't negotiate. I just, and this is what I learned in IT. I mean, I mention a prize and that's it. You take it or you don't take it. So just find someone else. So that was the reason why he was not at the first tournament. And then later the blindfold was added, which he didn't like or said that he didn't like. It was very unusual that suddenly you were playing blindfold. How unusual was it? How difficult did you find it? Or how strange did you think it was? Because this is what was done from the second tournament onwards, that the half of the games was rapid and half of them were blindfold.
Okay, first the Kasparov story. I was wondering whether I had the right to share it, but I'm glad you did. Because it is thing. And I'm lucky I was 22 when the Amber tournament started. Later on, you get slightly more resistant. But when you're 21, 22, you're ready to try anything and nothing seems like an imposition. And so I barely noticed the blindfold. Maybe I was apprehensive when I got there, but a couple of days later, we realized we're not that ridiculous at it, and then you relaxed. 93 wasn't a good year for me. 94, I won with my best, maybe the highest score ever reached in the Amber tournament. But in 93, I didn't do that. I didn't have very mixed feelings about blindfold, because there are also games where I was, I think Larry blundered something against me and somebody else blundered something against me. So once you get some breaks, you realize, well, it's basically fair to you. And I had no issues with it. And in some way, 93 was the normal year where we came back from in the clouds in Roquebrune. And we came to an ordinary hotel, the Metropole.
Metropole.
Just a garden variety hotel in Monaco. And again, we stayed in fantastic rooms. And there's the casino nearby. We'd go there. And, more everyday tournament. Oh, I can't handle all these heights. And of course, Pickett would constantly do these routines with me, where he would talk about, maybe we can tell your viewers, the listeners, that Jeroen specializes in irony sometimes. So he just warned.
Well, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, some warning. Yeah, warning. That's good.
He would say things like, it's tough here, and today my breakfast came late, and we'd both just start laughing because I think the subtext was always, my God, we're lucky to be here. So,
yeah.
And I'm, I think I'm generally grateful because There were later years when, you know, as you're hitting your late 30s, your 40, you think, oh, another change this year, and this is not so great. And we become the person we were caricaturing a little bit, making fun of a little bit, where you start saying, ah, but the coffee's not so nice. And so on. But it was fantastic for me. It started in 92 because I must be one of the most successful players, if not even the successful after 20 years. And I look back with a lot of sympathy for people like Polugevsky and Bent Larsen and so on, because this was slightly alien for them. I mean, for them, rapid chess is what maybe bullet is now to us. It's this alien world, and we approach it rather tentatively. But I realized that for us, it was so good. We enjoyed it, and we became good at it as well, and that's it. There was no big deal. And some things should happen to you when you're young. That's clear.
But it's definitely important to mention this, that when this started, I mean, rapid was controversial. Many people didn't like it at all. It's so, I mean, it feels like the most normal thing in the world now, but it was not at the time. And well, you wondered if you had the best result there. Well, you have the highest percentage over all those years. It's 62.63%. And while you won five times, what I find striking was there was a couple of players who really excelled there, and you had the feeling that they really were trying to do their very best. So, I mean, it's not only you, it's Vladimir Kramnik, it's Levon Aronian, Alexander Morozevich, and you felt that despite the relaxed atmosphere, there was enormous ambition to do well.
Yes, and this is, first of all, a contradiction to many people who'd say, it's just a fun tournament, because once you were there, you fought quite hard. Because as all chess players will realize, you spoil a blindfold game, it doesn't matter. You can be in the lap of luxury. It simply doesn't matter. There are days in Monaco I felt miserable, and so on. A couple of things more I'll mention. Monaco became a kind of refuge. Whenever I had a bad year in, I didn't have that many bad years, if I can say, but I had some lousy years or very mediocre years in Linares. And then I knew that after Linares, I will be going to Monaco. Mm-hmm. And then you could, so 2005, famously, 94, there were many years I had a tough year in Linares. But then I knew I get back home, I unpack and think, and then a few days we're off to after the Amber tournament.
Yeah.
And that was that was our attitude to it a little bit. And we took it extremely seriously. I mean, we prepared for it just as well as anything else and so on. I mean, first of all, the prizes were attractive. As I said, if you had a good game, you felt good the whole evening, and you knew that feeling was worth it. And of course, if your tournament is lousy after round six, then you become a bit playful and you may experiment here and there. But anyway, every further defeat still weighs on you. So it was a top competitive event, both in rapid and in blindfold. And what was it? I think maybe, I don't know if it was evident the first year, but very soon it was clear that the quality in blindfold can often be higher than the rapid. It's not always.
Some amazing games for playing.
A lot of people will be confused to realize that the blunders they think they saw in blindfold actually happened at the rapid the same day and so on.
You love chess. Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website, newinchess.com/magazine, for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
We have to talk about Lobo. We have to talk about John Nunn. So let's, you know, I'll just, without you asking the question, I'll say. Lobo became a legend at Roquebrune for us. Those of us, for whom he was a chess playing legend, but I think there was 1 year where we experienced chess commentary during a time scramble because, you know, the other people were playing. We were in the lounge. And so, you know, Yasser and Larry are egging him on and everyone is in the lounge, players' lounge, watching this game. And Lobo has worked himself up to a tempo. He's, my God, this is a ridiculous move. What is he doing? You know, the full Lobo performance, often streaming in multiple languages. And, you know, he's just, he's just there. And then in the end, the game ends in a blunder. It kind of settles, let's say, not the best game ever played. And at some point, Lobo says, I have no words. And I remember, as if it was yesterday, that Larry tells him, please, anything but that. So that was nice. Of course, for all of us, Lobo was the entertainment in Amber. He would, you know, he would do commentary. He would talk about stuff. Later on, I had profound conversations with him there. I had fun things with him there. Pickett and me would often go out with him somewhere and yap around. So that was... that was the tournament where I spent the most time with Lobo. John Nunn played for... Lobo actually played longer than John Nunn, but John Nunn played for a couple of years. And then 1 year he came there and he said, I said, hi, John, were you invited as a guest? He said, no, I have a job here. I said, what is that? He said, every day I have to point at a game and say, put a diagram there. And they will do it. And that's my job. And we thought he had the best job in the world. So Docky would come. So for me, part of Amber was the company. It, you know, if you know that you can always find Lobo to chat in the evening or John. Yeah. Very often I'd have conversations with John. I would ask him all my doubts in what's happening in science and what's happening in math and astronomy. And he would sit there and explain to me. So... both of them, it was really a lot of fun. Probably with the others as well. I had some conversations with Karpov there and so on. The rule in Amber was you leave all your fighting wherever it was. Even in 98, I would not say that I think already in Vikensee, my relations with Karpov were completely fine. I mean, the background, there was an intense... thing about Groningen and Lausanne, and for a few days, you know, that tension is there. But by the time in Vikensee, already it was nice. But it was understood that when we got to Amber, then, and I think even Vladdy and Veselin were always having fun in Amber. Amber was an escape from the world. You went there and you left everything at the door. So that was very nice. The excursions every year. Every year there'll be very thoughtful excursions all over the place. This wasn't always possible for me to join. So the first few years I was not joining them because Schengen didn't exist yet. I could not go to Italy without, you know, going through a visa application again and things like that. So, but that would be the only one, right? It's only Italy or France. There's no other country. So I remember they went to San Remo 1 year, and I was very fascinated with the idea that I could go to a town which Alekhine played against. Nimzowitz, right?
1930.
Yeah. And then I realized, it's in Italy. I'm not even going to try. So I think, but after 96, I think most of the excursions I went. There were one or two I skipped. And they never made a big deal about it. If you wanted to come, you came. Otherwise, no. There was a laser shoot. We had a couple of 2 years of laser shooting. We had some... in 93, we went on this Yop's yacht out into the harbor and went out and came back. Simply, despite the fact that we were competitive at the tournament, it was the tournament, I think, which gave me the most pleasurable experiences and things like that. So I really enjoyed that aspect.
Yeah, I always thought that it was such a funny stark contrast. I mean, as you say, there was always Linares, and then the next event for most players was Amber. And in Linares, everyone has his own table. People don't mix. You stick to your own table, your own crowd. And then suddenly these same people go there. And I mean, it was just a normal tradition that people would not go back to their room, but watch the other games in the other sessions and be very funny. I mean, all the comments there were just great to follow. I remember, I think maybe it was you at some point. There was somebody that a game was really going off the rails, and he said, "Okay, let's when they come back here, let's all sing David Bowie's Absolute Beginners," and these things were normal.
Yes, I think it was one tournament where we could all be private and friends at the same time, and it felt like a refuge. In no other tournament would that dynamic between the players exist. Only in Amber.
Yeah. And then, well, as you said, Jeroen Piquet, he was very close to Joop van Oostrom, and he went to work for him at some point, which many people believed was that he was going to work there as a chess assistant or whatever. And I always have to explain, no, he was just working as the head of the family office and really doing serious work. And of course, when he started working there, then, I mean, he suddenly was in a totally different role. And I remember the opening of the first tournament where he had this new role, and we were standing there on a terrace of the hotel, just overlooking the Mediterranean, and we're just wondering what will Jeroen be like now. And he walks out and he's on the phone, and he sees us, and the first thing he says, do you remember that one?
What was it? Sell all my stocks in Tokyo? No.
Yeah, he says sell everything.
Sell everything.
Then we knew he definitely had not changed.
Yes, but at the same time, from his perspective, it must be different, because he was living there now, so you could hardly get excited about going there when you just live there all the time. But yes, Jeroen, I remember he told me in Prague in 2002 that he was going to stop and move to work with Joop, and he explained, well, it's too good a thing to turn down. And then I saw him the next year in Amber, and I had skipped to 2002 because I'd had a very tough year in 2001, and I was just thing. And I remember Jeroen said, "Don't worry, I'm retiring, so we'll get you back in." And I said, "Okay."
Yeah. No, but it was, well, so important to so many players. I remember at one point, I mean, for Ivanchuk, as you said, he was the only one who played all 20 editions. He had this dramatic loss against Wesley So in Ханты-Мансийск in the World Cup. And he immediately announced the end of his career. He said, I'm giving up chess. And it was a big thing. I mean, people were talking about this. I mean, have you heard Ivanchuk has just announced that he's quitting chess? And the next day I spoke to a colleague. He said, "Did you hear? I mean, Ivanchuk is..." I say, "I'm not so sure, because last night I got an email from him where he accepted the invitation to Monaco, and it was full of exclaims, like, "Dear Dick, exclaim, of course I play, exclaim." And this was just 2 hours after he quit chess. So it was very reassuring. So
yes, I think the first time you get this reaction, it's tough, but slowly you realize that these are just moments of drama. I mean, I completely missed till the last day, I was surprised that I had no inkling that Gary was actually going to stop in Linares 2005. I had the feeling, well, it's not like Gary to make these noises, but, you know, it's of course he's not going to stop. And then it turned out he actually stopped because I couldn't understand that he had such a good tournament. I couldn't understand, but okay, that made sense later. But
anyway. Yeah. So well, let's say, looking back on Amber, what surprised me, and maybe it surprises you as well, is that when after 20 editions, the family decided to stop the tournament, then I thought, okay, that there must be someone who thinks, okay, this is a great thing to do. Let's continue this. And no one ever tried. I mean, do you think now we're looking at freestyle chess and people are going, being very enthusiastic about that. Would there still be a place for blindfold chess?
I don't see why not. It is fun. You can do... I don't see why not, actually. Come to think of it. Mm-hmm. It's not a variant, but it's got this fun side. And even the Amber tournaments were actually quite theoretical. Many of the games are very high class, played long theoretical lines and so on. So people are just playing their normal repertoire there. I don't see why not. But
do you have favorites amongst your blindfold games that you think, yeah, that was really a very good game? I mean, there must have been many good games, but something where you think, okay, this can go in the best game collection. Why not?
Yes, but I have to look it up because I'm certainly not sure which ones were rapid, which ones were blind. I mean, for me, the blending is there. Yeah. I think I played it in Amber there, but I didn't even... After a while, you stop thinking, oh, this is blind, it's special because it's blind. You stop thinking like that. Yeah. There must be... multiple blindfold games I'm quite proud of. If I sat for 15 minutes, I would find them all.
What was that one of your tournament victories that had a special significance for you there that you think, oh yeah, that there was so much other stories connected to that?
I think my wins in 94 and 2005 are special because 2005 I won 2 rounds to spare. I mean, that is 4 games to spare. I had already won the tournament, if I remember correctly. Or maybe I needed to make a draw or something. But anyway, you realize the margin is insane. And 94 was closer. Vladdy was pushing me all the way. I mean, I made 17.5 out of 22. And Vladdy was 16.5, which is also one of the highest scores. So those 2 years... And that's the problem. You tend to exaggerate how well you played and so on. But simply, I was very practical and collected the points very efficiently. So,
Well, you drew these parallels with the tournaments in Corsica and in Frankfurt and Mainz. Well, they were all rapid. Does that say something about a certain preference? I mean, your pleasant memories, are they, well, to a large extent, well, maybe... connected to rapid play, or is it just the atmosphere at these tournaments that appeal to you more?
It's a bit of everything. I mean, I have this feeling that your best memories are always where you do well rather than the most luxurious venues, but it's nice when they coincide. But it was clear that rapid chess came very naturally to me. Whereas, I mean, even if you look at my world titles, there was 2000, but the subsequent ones came later and were kind of hard acquired. And that was fine. I was fine with that. But in rapid, it came early and freely. And I think that also reinforced the fact. But these were spectacular locations as well. So, but I've gone to spectacular locations and played badly and hated the tournament forever. So, you don't need these things to work out. But all these events, mostly when I think of the towns itself, when I think of Corsica, well, Corsica is just the island version of south of France, if you like. And Frankfurt Mainz while I even moved there and was living there for many years. So these are just, but it was clear that I was always, I gravitated naturally to Rapid and even Blitz in those days.
Yeah. So how, what is your first image that you see when you think back to Reggio? Because what I remember from Reggio was that it was in winter, there was an awful lot of fog, and even if the tournament was going very well, it was very easy to almost feel depressed by the fog because you didn't see the sky for several days. What are the images that come to mind when you're thinking back to Reggio?
I remember that hotel on Christmas and coming out of the street. And I remember some of the shop windows. The street has changed totally beyond all recognition. But I remember the shop windows. I remember the snacks. I remember the room which I went for breakfast and then seeing no one around. So I remember that very well. I remember the venue reasonably well. I kind of remember how we came out of the hotel into the open space and things like that. After I finished this tournament, I had to, of course, go and fax all my, I had to call my parents and fax a friend and, you know, that kind of thing. Right. So that they would find out. I don't remember anything about a fog or anything. Having said that, of course, a lot of details. I can't remember I sort of remember the room, but I don't remember. The tournament hall I can remember, but nothing around it. I sort of have this image of how we used to come out of the hotel, but nothing more. So, but of course, that was just 1 year. Many, all these other memories, of course, because you go there the same place, you know it inside out.
No, it's. I mean, at the start, I mentioned that your list of victories is so incredibly long, but it's, whenever I think of your victories, then it always starts with this one. And I remember that there was an Italian magazine, they wrote, Indian boy throws last remains of USSR primacy into crisis. And I thought that was a great heading. And it happened. Yeah,
the USSR itself was in a crisis.
That was 92.
It does feel weird because for all of us who grew up with the Soviet Union as being this chess-playing monolith, suddenly to see them break apart like that was quite unusual.
Yeah. Okay, Fishy. Well, thanks a lot for going back on this trip down memory lane, going to Reggio Emilia with or without fog, and of course the beautiful tournaments in Corsica and Frankfurt and Mainz and Monaco. So thank you very much for sharing these memories. It's been wonderful to listen to that.
Yeah, thanks, Dagger.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. If this podcast has gotten you in the mood to read a fine chess book or to subscribe to the wonderful New in Chess magazine, then please have a look at our shop on our website newinchess.com, where you can treat yourself to a great chess read. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next time for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.